Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1199, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. During the second segment, I will air the remarks of Palestinian poet and writer Mus'ab Abu Toha, speaking at the United Nations in New York as a survivor and a witness to the genocide in Gaza. And during the third segment, I will air the remarks of Sahar Francis, Palestinian lawyer working with Palestinian prisoners' issues for 30 years, testifying at the Gaza Tribunal final session about sexual assault and mass imprisonment. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 825 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip while bombing, shelling, and destroying areas on both sides of the vague yellow line, and while preventing necessary humanitarian aid, medical supplies, caravans, and shelter materials from entering. Just hours ago, on Thursday, Israeli forces killed at least three Palestinians, including children, and injured dozens in drone attacks on tent shelters in the Mawasi area of Khan Yunis. Other attacks on Thursday were reported in Jabalia in northern Gaza, also on tent shelters housing forcibly displaced Palestinians. On Wednesday evening, an Israeli airstrike bombed the home of a family in the Tufah neighborhood of Gaza City, killing at least two Palestinians and injuring several others. Israel killed a five-year-old child and her uncle on Monday, who were inside a tent shelter in the Mawasi Khan Yunis displacement camp. Two other children were wounded in the attack, according to hospital officials. On January 6th, a 15-year-old child, Abdulrahman Al-Fajim, was killed by Israeli artillery shelling targeting the Bani Suhaila area of eastern Khan Yunis. Journalist Ibrahim Kanan captured footage of Abdulrahman's family painfully grieving over his body. Israeli forces killed three Palestinians, including a fisherman, on January 4th in separate attacks in Khan Yunis, as the Israeli army destroyed more infrastructure in northern Gaza. Al Jazeera reported that quadcopter drones dropped explosives on several homes and fired artillery shells in areas of eastern Gaza City. On January 2nd, a man was killed in eastern Khan Yunis. Journalist Mazen Brim captured footage of his family and loved ones mourning over his body. Brim reported that Ahmed Hossam Zidan Naim was shot and killed by an Israeli gun mounted on a crane. Israeli forces have not stopped destroying homes and structures on both sides of the invisible and ever-moving so-called yellow line. On January 3rd, reporter Tamar Dalul recorded Israeli demolitions of residential buildings inside the Zaytun neighborhood southeast of Gaza City. Journalist Abid Sabah walked through the ruins of Jabalia refugee camp on January 2nd, where Israeli forces have continuously destroyed homes, tent shelters, and streets in the green zone west of the so-called yellow line. He says, quote, "This is the explosion that just happened. This is an area that is supposed to be a green area. People were unable to return to this place because of these daily acts of Israeli violations and targeting."
هذه الانفجارات اللي سمعتوها الان في منطقه خضراء هذا مخيم جباليا احنا في قلب المخيم هذه المنطقه المفترض ان تكون منطقه خضراء هذا الشارع تحديدا هو الشارع المؤدي الى المربع الأصفر، هذا هو الانفجار اللي حصل الآن. هذه منطقة مفترض تكون خضراء، الناس ما قدرت ترجع لهذا المكان بسبب هذه الأفعال اليومية من خروقات واستهدافات إسرائيلية، خيام بسيطة أو أعداد قليلة من الناس اللي قدرت ترجع لهذه المناطق. لكن فعليا الوضع كثير صعب في هذه المنطقة بشكل يومي، في خروقات وفي استهدافات إسرائيلية.
That was reporter Abed Sabah in Jabalia refugee camp. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza warned this week that the widespread and deepening shortage of medical supplies due to Israel's ongoing blockade is putting patients at serious risk. On Wednesday, the Health Ministry said that the lack of laboratory consumables includes a shortage of 75% of needed chemistry testing materials and a 90% depletion of blood bank and blood transfusion supplies. Such shortages are, quote, exacerbating the crisis to the point where it may hinder patient diagnoses and surgical procedures. Essential tests for patients with endocrine disorders, cancer, kidney transplants, electrolyte imbalances, and blood count panels have been suspended, the ministry added. At the same time, the Israeli government announced it was revoking the operating licenses from nearly 40 international human rights and humanitarian organizations, many of which have been working in the occupied West Bank and Gaza for decades and have helped coordinate the humanitarian response in lieu of Israel's systematic attacks on and undermining of the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA. The Israeli government had approved the registration process plan in March 2025 to come into effect on January 1st, 2026. Among the 37 groups Israel is targeting are Doctors Without Borders, the Norwegian Refugee Council, Oxfam, Care International, Relief International, Mercy Corps, Medical Aid for Palestinians, the American Friends Service Committee, and Defense for Children International Palestine. The Israeli decision to not renew the licenses of these organizations was announced with the pretext of non-compliance with new, unjust, and arbitrary registration conditions imposed by the Israeli authorities, said Euromed Human Rights Monitor. Quote, the new registration conditions invoked by Israel are not limited to technical administrative requirements, the human rights group stated. They are based on a system of criteria used as tools of inclusion or exclusion and include punitive standards linked to an organization's positions or those of any of its staff on boycott, what Israel terms delegitimization, or support for international accountability mechanisms. Israel's registration scheme, Euromed noted, imposes requirements obliging these groups to submit extensive and sensitive data on their staff, particularly Palestinian employees working inside the Gaza Strip, along with detailed information on funding sources, partners, operational mechanisms, and field movements. These demands, quote, go far beyond legitimate administrative oversight and amount to the collection of data that could expose identities and networks, placing individuals at risk of targeting, persecution, or blackmail. This decision, Euromed added, is designed to create ever more unlivable conditions with the aim of forcibly displacing the population. Israeli claims about the existence of alternatives are nothing more than deliberate deception. No other local or international actor possesses the logistical capacity or infrastructure to fill this massive gap, particularly amid escalating Israeli restrictions on humanitarian organizations and on the entry of aid and essential materials into the Gaza Strip. It also forms part of a broader Israeli strategy to undermine independent access to facts on the ground and monopolize the narrative of events in Gaza, the group says. Quote, foreign doctors and international aid workers serve as independent eyewitnesses capable of observing and documenting patterns of violations, including recurring injury types, the effects of weapons used, indicators of famine and shortages of essential supplies, and conveying these findings to relevant international bodies. Their presence has even partially mitigated the isolation imposed on Gaza since October 2023. The American Friends Service Committee, which began working in Gaza in 1948 to organize relief efforts for Palestinian refugees who had been expelled from their land by Israel, says that it joins the other international organizations in calling on Israel to remove these restrictions. This past week, the AFSC stated that, quote, these requirements are part of a systematic effort to arbitrarily criminalize humanitarian organizations, dismantle aid infrastructure, and inflict further harm on Gaza's civilian population. They are in violation of international law and humanitarian principles. The registration process, the AFSC remarked, quote, compromises humanitarian principles, independence, and access to civic space. It also imposes prohibitively difficult reporting requirements and requires organizations to submit complete staff lists and other sensitive information about staff and their families to the Israeli government. The International Court of Justice has ruled that Israel's occupation in the Palestinian territory is unlawful. Disclosing operational information to a government credibly accused of genocide and apartheid endangers the lives of our staff and partners. Israel has already killed more than 500 aid workers since October 2023. For these reasons, AFSC made the difficult decision to not reapply for registration with the Israeli government. The European Commission, for its part, issued a toothless condemnation of Israel's registration restrictions on international organizations. Quote, to deliver aid rapidly, safely, and at the scale required, international NGOs must be able to operate in a sustained and predictable way. Without them, life-saving assistance cannot reach people in need, the Commission observed. But it did not offer even a threat of revocation of funds, weapons, or political cover for Israel and its crimes of ongoing genocide carried out by either bombs or bureaucracy. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and wounded a Palestinian teenaged child on Wednesday during an invasion into the town of Beita and a nearby village south of Nablus. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said that the 17-year-old boy was shot in the abdomen. On January 5th, Israeli forces stormed Birzeit University near Ramallah, opening fire on students during the assault. 11 Palestinians were injured, 3 by live fire, 3 by shrapnel, and 5 who were treated for tear gas inhalation, according to the health ministry. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said that 3 students were shot in the legs and hospitalized for treatment. Local sources told the Anadolu news agency that Israeli forces raided the campus following a student event held in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and coincided with preparations to screen the film The Voice of Hind Rajab, the true story of the 5-year-old girl in January 2024 who was trapped inside a car along with the corpses of her family members who were killed by Israeli soldiers, with the soldiers executing Hind just hours later, ultimately shooting the car more than 350 times and evading justice ever since. Israeli forces invaded the campus shortly before the scheduled film screening, which had been planned as part of student-led activities, the sources told Anadolu. Birzeit University student Mohamed Horeini narrated the raid on his Instagram account.
No one can go in and out from the university. It's all surrounded.
It seems that he's aiming to shoot.
They're now shooting live bullets.
One student was shot in the leg.
Another injury.
9 people were shot and at least 32 suffered suffocation from tear gas and shrapnel wounds by the stun grenades.
They're now on the entrance. It seems that they are going to leave. No, they're not going to. This is part of the daily life for the Palestinian students under occupation. Education is controlled and terrorized by the occupation. How much they don't want Palestinians to be educated was part of our struggle against the occupation.
That was Mohammed Hourani on campus at Beir Zeit University on Monday. Hourani is the co-founder of Youth of Samoud, a human rights group inside the besieged villages of Masafer Yatta, south of Al-Khalil in the West Bank. Israel arrested and abducted Palestinian journalist Inas Ikhlawi after storming her home in the town of Itna in the southern West Bank earlier this week. The Palestinian Center for Development and Media Freedoms condemned Ikhlawi's arrest and detention, saying they consider it an arbitrary arrest that is part of a systematic policy targeting Palestinian journalists. The center said that this was the second arrest and abduction of journalists this week. Reporter Salim Suhail Al-Salman was arrested by Israeli forces on January 1st after storming his house in the southern neighborhood of Tulkarem City, seizing his phone and the phones of several family members. Just weeks ago, on December 26th, Israeli forces abducted leading political researcher and writer Sami Orabi from his home in the town of Rafat, north of Jerusalem. Orabi was placed under a six-month administrative detention order, a draconian measure without charge or trial. Israeli forces threatened a children's football field with demolition orders this week in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem. A journalist with Mondo Weiss reported from the pitch on January 6th.
Israel has issued a demolition order to demolish this children's football field in Aida refugee camp. And this is probably the last training they're going to have on this football pitch before the military comes in and turns it all into rubble and then bill Aida Youth Center for the cost. The football pitch has been a source of joy for the kids here. It's a break from the overcrowded refugee camp surrounded by a giant wall, several military watchtowers, and frequent Israeli military attacks on the area. It fosters hope, which is exactly why Israel wants to demolish it, just like they do to schools, homes, and playgrounds all across Palestine. This is a message to the community here, that resilience will be punished, even if it's just kids playing football.
That was from Mondo Weiss. On January 4th, Israeli forces expelled a family from their home in the Batan al-Hawa neighborhood of Silwan in occupied East Jerusalem, and handed it over to a group of Israeli settlers with Ataret Kohanim, an organization that facilitates the appropriation of Palestinian property in Jerusalem. As a result, eight people, including three children, were displaced in favor of the Israeli settler organization, the United Nations reported. According to the family, in November 2025, the Israeli Supreme Court rejected the family's appeal. The family subsequently filed another petition and had a hearing scheduled for December 21st. However, prior to the court's ruling, the Israeli Enforcement and Collection Authority issued a final eviction notice, ordering the family to vacate the property by January 5th. Following the expulsion, Israeli settlers took over the building, sealed its doors and windows with metal sheets, and raised Israeli flags over the home. This is the sixth expulsion of Palestinians in Batan al-Hawa since February 2024, which in total has resulted in the displacement of 13 Palestinian families, comprising 57 people, including 27 children. These families are among more than 90 families in Batan al-Hawa, comprising over 450 people and 200 children, who have been at risk of forced displacement due to eviction cases filed against them by the Ataret Kohanim Settler Organization, the UN said. Meanwhile, Israeli forces continue to demolish homes in Tulkarem. On the last day of 2025, Israeli military bulldozers began demolishing dozens of homes in the Nur Shams refugee camp. According to local community sources, Israeli authorities rejected a legal request submitted on behalf of the families to suspend the demolitions that targeted both single-family houses and multi-unit residential buildings, affecting approximately 70 households, all of whom had already been displaced from the camp, the United Nations stated. Israeli bulldozers and military forces raided the town of Anata, north of Jerusalem, on Wednesday and demolished an iron factory under the pretext of construction without an Israeli permit. And Israeli municipal officials issued a demolition order for part of a Palestinian elementary school and kindergarten in the Old City of Jerusalem this week. The Jerusalem governorate said in a statement that the occupation municipality granted the school administration a one-week deadline to demolish the upper section, which spans 35 square meters, warning that it would carry out the demolition itself if the order is not implemented, Wafa News reported. Under the pretext of building without permits, which are rarely granted to Palestinians in the city, the Israeli municipality has been demolishing or forcing Palestinians to demolish their own houses as part of a policy aimed at restricting Palestinian expansion and growth in occupied Jerusalem, Wafa added. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Israel Block's entry of eye drops for blind people in Gaza by Saeed Al-Salul, writing from Gaza. Before the genocide erupted in the Gaza Strip, specialized institutions for people who were blind or had limited vision worked actively despite the tight siege on the enclave, Saeed writes. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, ran a rehabilitation center for the visually impaired, offering programs to children aged 8 to 12. UNRWA's rehabilitation center also provided braille machines, canes, visual aids, and recreational activities like sports and music. Another governmental school located in Al-Zahra neighborhood in the central Gaza Strip offered people who were blind or with limited vision middle and secondary education. The Islamic University of Gaza also embraced blind students. It provided them with accessible facilities, specialized technical tools, dedicated staff, and an adapted inclusion approach. Ahmed Abu Al-Jidyan, who is completely blind and a close friend of this writer, earned distinction in some courses as a student of English at the Islamic University. The Islamic University was the spark that guided our hearts to enlightenment, Abu Al-Jidyan said. In November 2021, a few months before his graduation, Abu Al-Jidyan was able to write a play and, alongside other classmates, perform it before a large audience within the university. After graduating in 2022, he started working as a freelance content writer in digital advocacy. In October 2023, Abu Al-Jidyan's life was upended when he and his family were forced to flee their house in Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, relocating to a tent in Deir al-Balah, central Gaza Strip. In May 2024, Abu Al-Jidyan received news that he said he couldn't bear. Their house was destroyed. As a blind person, he struggled to get food aid and medicine he used to get before the genocide due to the displacement and the lack of communication with the specialized centers which had previously helped him. Abu Al-Jidyan also couldn't continue his job as the connection to the internet in the tent was scarce, and he had already lost his laptop in his house back in Jabalia. Even in the ceasefire now, life lost its meaning, Abu Al-Jidyan said, adding that the October ceasefire is a fragile one. It wasn't only his life that was upended. So were the lives of the other 10,000 pre-genocide people who were blind or had limited vision in Gaza. The Electronic Intifada interviewed Ali Tuaima, the director of the Gaza Forum Association for the Visually Impaired, a place aiding people who are blind or have limited vision. Many people with visual impairments were killed during this war, while some suffered double disability, a visual and physical one, Tuaima said. Many others remain imprisoned and were tortured by the occupation. Tuaima said that currently there is not a single rehabilitation center for blind people in Gaza. From the first days of the genocide, Israel bombed the Islamic University of Gaza and later in February 2024, rendered the UNRWA's rehabilitation center out of service. Israel also, Tuaima said, obliterated schools or institutions for blind people, including the building that housed Tuaima's association. In September, the Ministry of Health in Gaza reported that since October 2023, more than 1,500 people were added to the 10,000 people who are blind or with limited vision in Gaza before the genocidal war began. As Israel still prevents the entry of eye drops and treatments, nearly 4,500 people were at risk of having eye conditions, up from 4,000 in May. That increase aligns with accounts Tuema, the director of the Association for Blind People, received from several doctors, who told him that some of the people with pre-existing eye conditions or diseases lost their sight due to the lack of proper surgical instruments and treatments while the vision of others deteriorated. Tuema and his association were unable to provide the necessary treatments for people with eye conditions as Israel hinders the entry of essential medicines. Everything related to the lives of the blind has become piles of rubble. There is no training, no rehabilitation, no education, no employment, no assistive devices, and a shortage of medications, Tuema said. We call upon local and international community organizations and human rights organizations to take serious action to assist people with disabilities in general and those with visual impairments in particular. Those are excerpts from Israel Block's entry of eye drops for blind people in Gaza by Saeed Al-Salul, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Last week, we showed the celebration for a cadre of physicians who studied for and passed their medical boards while surviving the genocide. This week, a graduation ceremony was held for 230 medical doctors outside Al-Shifa Hospital. As social media user Aboud Batah commented, quote, "These graduates did not learn medicine in safe classrooms, but in the field, among the wounded and the martyrs, under bombardment and with limited resources. They learned what it means to be a doctor, a human being first and foremost, and how to save lives when death is so close." An enormous banner was hung on the destroyed facade of Al-Shifa Hospital, commemorating the deans of the Faculty of Medicine and senior doctors who were executed by Israel. Dr. Izzedine Lulu, one of these graduates, spoke with members of Doctors Against Genocide about the ceremony and what it means to complete medical school during a genocide.
We were able to stand yesterday and celebrate 230 newly graduated doctors. Until yesterday, I was one of these students, and at the same time, I was also one of the organizers of this graduation ceremony through the SME Foundation with the sponsors of Doctor Against Genocide and some of the other organization with the Peace and Human Smile. That dual role matters because this graduation was not organized for students or for foundations from outside. It was organized by people who lived the same reality, walked the same corridors, and studied under the same conditions. This was the largest medical graduation ceremony held in Gaza during the war. It took place at Al-Shifa Medical Complex, a place when a place known globally, not just a hospital, but as a symbol of suffering and medical resistance. These students did not study medicine in normal circumstances. They studied during bombardment, displacement, hunger, electricity cuts, and the loss of teachers, classmates, and family members. Many of them would attend doctors after night of air strikes. Some came to clinical training straight from funerals, and yet they graduated. That alone tells you something powerful about who these future doctors are, inshallah, like Dr. Adnan Al-Borj.
That was Dr. Izzedine Lulu speaking to Doctors Against Genocide earlier this week. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. On November 25, 2025, the United Nations Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People held a special meeting at the United Nations headquarters in New York to commemorate the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People. There were several speakers at that event, and I'm going to share one of them with you today, and that is the address of Mus'ab Abu Toha, Palestinian poet, writer, founder of the Edward Said Library, and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for series of New York essays on suffering of Palestinians in Gaza, speaking as a survivor and witness to the genocide in Gaza. In his talk, he recounts his family's history of displacement from Jaffa, his birth in a refugee camp, his abduction and torture, and the loss of loved ones to Israeli airstrikes. We will also hear him reading excerpts from his own poetry that capture childhood dreams, loss, and life under the rubble in Gaza. Let's take a listen.
I am the child, the grandchild, the great-grandchild of refugees from Jaffa. I was born in a refugee camp. I survived the first 2 months of the ongoing genocide. It is an ongoing genocide. I was abducted by the Israeli forces. I was subjected to torture. I was sexually abused by the Israeli soldiers. And I'm not going today. I mean, I was invited to read some poems, but I couldn't but start off by reflecting on what I heard from the distinguished speakers. It is very important to call for a Palestinian state, but it is also very important to hear what actions the United Nations is taking to make this a real thing, because emphasizing things over and over again is not going to bring or end the suffering of the Palestinian people. I'm not going to speak today about my father-in-law, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike. I'm not going to talk about my four cousins. Two of them were killed with their husband and their children. I'm not going to speak today about my grandfather, who died in the refugee camp at the age of 72, because there was no hospital, no doctors, no ambulances. Even at the time, there was no phone signal because Israel destroyed everything. None of what I'm going to speak about, none of the poems that I'm going to read, is going to provide shelter to the children who are now surviving the winter in Gaza. Thank you again for being here. I would like to say that the humanitarian aid, by the way, the last resolution that was passed, 2803, was passed on my 33rd birthday, November 17th. While this is a good step, but this is not enough, humanitarian aid, food, medicine, shelter should not require a UN resolution or a plan. Ending the suffering of a besieged population should never be a conditional or negotiable. There is only one resolution that I think the UN Security Council should be considering. One, end the Israeli occupation and free the Palestinian people. Two, hold Israel accountable, because I didn't see or hear anyone talking about holding Israel accountable for the war crimes. I was wounded at the age of 60. No one mentioned that, oh, we're going to investigate how this child in 2009 was injured. I have some relatives, a second cousin of mine, Muhammad Ayman Abu Toha, was killed this September, 2 months ago, along with his wife and their four children. One child, 2 years old, remains under the rubble until today. I didn't hear anyone, not the UN, not the United States, not the European Union, calling for ways to recover the bodies of the Palestinians whose bodies are under the rubble until today. This is dehumanizing, not even to hear any step being taken to recover the bodies. Not only were they killed, but their bodies remain under the rubble until today. Yesterday I posted, it was the second anniversary of the killing of my close friend Ismail Abu Ghabin, who was killed with his parents, his two children, and his three sisters. That was November 2023. Now, the body of Ismail, my friend, who was an UNRWA teacher, I taught English at UNRWA schools in Gaza. Ismail was an Arabic language teacher, and his body, I swear to God, his body is under the rubble until today, along with his father and a 15-year-old sister. And no one is talking about recovering the body of this man and his father and his sister. And then two, hold Israel accountable for war crimes. Not only for that Israel committed over the past 2 years, but 77 years. Three, provide reparations for the Palestinian people. My grandparents' house in Jaffa, it is their own. It is their property that they were expelled from in 1948. It's not only the right of return is not a national right. It's not only a national right. It is a personal right. It is an individual right. Four, and this is very important, I don't hear anyone speaking about, to establish a Palestinian army that ensures the Palestinian people's protection and security. I don't hear anyone talking about the Palestinian people's security. Who's going to protect the Palestinian people from the settlers in the West Bank or even in the Gaza Strip? I don't hear anything about security of the Palestinian people. And last, the Palestinian people do not need a peace plan. What we need is a justice plan, a structure of accountability and self-determination led by the Palestinian people themselves. It may be difficult to imagine such a future right now, but it is time to stop accepting the illusion of peace processes that only entrench injustices. And now to poetry. My dreams as a child. I still have dreams about a room filled with toys my mother always promised we could have if we were rich. I still have dreams about seeing the refugee camp from a window on a plane. I still have dreams about seeing the animals I learned about in third grade, elephant, giraffe, kangaroo, and wolf. I still have dreams about running for miles and miles with no border blocking my feet, with no unexploded bombs scaring me off. I still have dreams about my favorite team playing soccer on the beach, me running on the beach, me waiting for the ball to come my way and run away with it. I dream still about my grandfather, Hassan, whose grave I don't know where it is right now because Israel destroyed the cemetery. I still dream about my grandfather, how much I want to pick oranges with him in Jaffa. But my grandfather died. Jaffa is occupied, and oranges no longer grow in his weeping groves. I will only read one poem because of the time. Under the Rubble, and this is a poem that I wrote after October 7th, because many of the poems were written before, and you cannot distinguish which was written before or after, because it's always been a genocide for us. This poem, Under the Rubble, was written after October 7th. She slept on her bed, never woke up again. Her bed has become her grave, a tomb beneath the ceiling of her room, the ceiling a cenotaph. No name, no year of birth, no year of death, no epitaph, only blood and a smashed picture frame in ruin next to her. In Jabalia camp, a mother collects her daughter's flesh in a piggy bank, hoping to buy her a plot on a river in a faraway land. A group of mute people were talking sign when a bomb fell. They fell silent. It rained again last night. The new plant looked for an umbrella in the garage. The bombing got intense, and our house looked for a shelter in the neighborhood. Now all of Gaza is looking for a shelter from Israel because everything has been destroyed. I leave the door to my room open so the words and in my books, the titles, names and of authors and publishers could flee when they hear the bomb. I became homeless once, but the rubble of my city covered the streets. They could not find a stretcher to carry your body. They put you on a wooden door they found under the rubble, your neighbors a moving wall. The scars on our children's faces will look for you. Our children's amputated legs will run after you. He left the house to buy some bread for his kids. News of his death made it home, but not the bread. No bread. Death sits to eat whoever remains of the kids. No need for a table, no need for bread. I'll skip one part. I changed the order of my books on the shelves. 2 days later, the war broke out. Beware of changing the order of your books. This is a question I asked when I was in Gaza in November 2023. Where should people go? Because every time, okay, this is a humanitarian zone. People go there, they got bombed. Literally, Ismail, when he was killed, he was in Nusayrat, in southern Gaza, where Israel told him to go with his, and he was killed there. So my question is still until today, where should people go? Should they build a big ladder and go up? But heaven has been blocked by the bombs and drones and the smoke of death. My son asks me whether when we return to Gaza, I could get him a puppy. I tell him, I promise, if we can find any. I ask my son if he wishes to become a pilot when he grows up. He says, he won't wish to drop bombs on people and houses. When we die, our souls leave our bodies, take with them everything they loved in our bedrooms, the makeup, the necklaces, the pens. And in Gaza, our bodies and rooms get crushed. Nothing remains for our souls. Even our souls, they remain stuck under the rubble for weeks. Now it's been 2 years. Thank you.
That was Mus'ab Abu Toha, Palestinian poet, writer, founder of the Edward Said Library, and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for a series of New Yorker essays on suffering of Palestinians in Gaza, speaking at a special meeting in New York organized by the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People to commemorate the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey in October 2025, Sahar Francis, Palestinian lawyer working with Palestinian prisoners issues for 30 years, testified about sexual assault and mass imprisonment. She spoke about the 9,100 Palestinian prisoners being held in Israeli jails, including 400 children, that are facing torture, arbitrary detention, mass detention campaigns, unfair trial procedures, lack of health treatment, solitary confinement, degrading treatment, killings inside prisons, and holding prisoners' bodies. And that these are not new practices, but have been systematic since 1948. In her talk, Sahar shares testimonies of Palestinian prisoners from Gaza and the West Bank. She also references leaked video from Sdeit Iman detention facility, where in July 2024, one Gazan detainee was raped brutally and hospitalized in critical condition. Let's listen to her testimony.
Thank you so much, respected and distinguished journey, to invite me to witness and to talk about my experience as a Palestinian lawyer who were working with the Palestinian prisoners' issues for the last 30 years, more or less, and what a difficult mission to speak after Ahmed and to speak after the first session in the morning and all the difficult stories we heard, and to talk about sexual harassment that the Palestinian prisoners endured in the last 2 years. First, allow me to remind ourselves that it really started in 1948 when Israel was using the issue of imprisonment and mass incarceration as the main tool and the main weapon in the hands of the new state to oppress, to control, and to erase the Palestinian society and people who remained inside the state after the creation of the state, and they imposed military regime on them up till 1966. And they continued with developing this military regime, military laws, and ways of oppression after the occupation in 1967. So torture, arbitrary detention, mass detention campaigns, unfair trial procedures, lack of health treatment, solitary confinement, degrading treatment, killings inside the prisons, holding the bodies of the prisoners. None of these practices actually started after October 23. Nothing of these practices were new or that we didn't document it for decades. All these grave violations the Palestinian prisoners were facing in a very, very systematic way Of course, in different phases and in different contexts since 48 till the genocide started. But what happened after the genocide on October 23, this was a very serious, significant increase in the mass arrest campaigns in relation to the short period. Because in the first intifada and in the second intifada, of course, thousands of people were arrested, but not in such a short period of 2 years to arrest more than 30,000 people from all Palestine, like from the West Bank, from Gaza, from 48 areas. It was a serious deterioration on the level of the lives of these prisoners and the conditions that these prisoners faced inside the detention facilities and in the prisons immediately from day one, couple of hours after Hamas attack on the 7th of October, the prison security units with the prison guards raided the cells and the rooms of the prisoners, and they started to subject them for very severe torture, physical attacks, and lots of abuses. The total number of the prisoners before the 7th of October was 5,200 people. Currently, there's 9,100. This is after releasing almost 2,000 in the exchange deal last week. This is includes 400 children that they are still in prison. This is includes 53 women that they are still in prison. This is includes more than 5,000 detainees held arbitrarily without any legal procedures according to the practice of administrative detention and unlawful competent. I can talk actually for hours about the conditions and the severe violations that these prisoners faced after the 7th of October, but I think I preferred, and it's really, believe me, very, very difficult to describe and talk about the level of torture and what they suffered in these months. Maybe it's enough to mention that already 80 people died. Just last week, we lost two detainees in for healthcare, lack of healthcare inside the prison. 80 people died in custody since the beginning of the genocide, where their bodies are still kept with the Israeli prison system. Allow me to read just few of the stories, the testimonies of the prisoners. And me and my colleagues in the Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, we visited in the last 2 years more than 900 people. So you can imagine the amount of testimonies and evidences and information we collected in the last 2 years. The first testimony is for a prisoner, R.A., I would name him. He was arrested from the Gaza Strip with his son. He was subjected to severe torture at the same place in the spot, beating him on his head and then taken him to the area in the Gaza envelope. On the way, the beating and torture continued. Upon reaching the area in the envelope, his clothes were changed, and he was placed in the barracks. The barracks is the local name for the detention facility for 5 days without being interrogated, without being questioned. After this period, they took him to the interrogation. He was beaten, tortured, and starved. He was made to sit on gravel and was prevented from moving. He was stuck on his face, and one of his ribs were broken. Every moment he made was accompanied by beating. After 3 months, he was taken back for further interrogation. He remained in the same barracks for 80 days, during which he was subjected for beatings and torture, including being sodomized with a stick twice, once at the beginning of his detention and once after 3 months. The second testimony actually is for a Palestinian journalist. And he was arrested from the West Bank, and he was tortured and attacked and sexually assaulted in Megiddo prison. And I would call him A.H. It's not the real name, of course. And when he describes that one day in Megiddo prison, he needed medical treatment, and the guards brought him to the way to the clinic, and in the way they were beating him and attacking him. And of course, the doctor checked him and he confirmed that there's nothing serious, there's no further treatment needed, and asked the guards to take him back to the section. So in the way back, he's describing, I was blindfolded, and when they dragged him back, one of the soldiers pointed to him and said, are you a journalist working for Al Jazeera? We will bring all the Al Jazeera people here. We will f*** them. Sorry, excuse me for this. And we will f*** their wives and sisters. They began to beat me with extreme violence. I was in severe pain, struggling to endure it. The beating lasted around 20 minutes, a mix of blows, insult, while I lay on the ground. He continues to describe all this painful experience. This continued for around 5 to 7 minutes until I felt them open a gate and push me inside somewhere. My vision was completely gone because of the blindfold. I realized they had taken me into a narrow place, which a very awful smell. Immediately they began removing the lower part of my clothes. While beating me severely, they ordered me, on your knees, head down. I sat on my knees and lowered my head into the floor. They had with them the magnometer to do the security, the device that they do the security check. They started to hit him with the magnometer. Then, to my shock, they tried to insert something into my rectum from behind. Instinctively, I tried to resist, but the pain was overwhelming, and eventually I could no longer fight back. Wherever object they were using, it felt like a stick. I felt they also tried to insert the magnometer, and he's continuing. The stick was not only inserted, but moved inside repeatedly, and I felt this happened at least 5 or 6 times. And he continues to describe how he was taken back to the cell. When I entered to the shower and removed my lower clothes, I noticed blood stains on them. I placed my hand on my rectum, and when I pulled it away, there was blood on my hand. And these two cases were not reported in the media, were not no one complained about this, no one was found accountable about this sexual assault. I will end. I'm sure most of you saw the leaked video about the Sdeity Man detention facility, where in July 24, one of the Gazan detainees was raped brutally, and he was hospitalized in a very critical conditions. And later on, they arrested 5 soldiers for this assault. This detainee was released in the last exchange deal, and we believe that this release came in order to close the legal case against the soldiers, so they will never be accountable for what they did. And this man, I visited him several times. I just talked to him before I came here, and he's broken. They attacked him. They started to attack him at 6 p.m. In the evening. They just took him from his cell, and they pushed him for an area that is not the cameras in the Sdeity Man section cannot reach it, where there's no video of the cameras, of the security cameras of the detention facility. But they were 7 to 10 soldiers, and they started to beat him and attack him very severely. He says that it lasted more or less half an hour, then he was started to feel exhausted, lying on the ground, unable to breathe, and kept telling them to let me breathe because I felt pain all over my body. I was lying on my stomach with everyone around me, and they continued to shock me. I felt a soldier insert a button from behind when my pants came down. They were all standing around and hitting me. They removed the blindfold in the middle of the beatings. And when I turned around, I saw the soldier that was pushing the button in his anus. The soldier lifted the button and tried to put it in my mouth while speaking in Arabic. I refused to open my mouth, so he placed it on the ground and forced me to grab it and put it in my mouth. Later, they took him back to his mattress and they told him not to dare to even tell a doctor because otherwise they will come back for him. I will end that without accountability, there's no justice. And this is why it's really very essential that the perpetrators should pay a price for all these grave violations that were committed systematically since 48 till today. Thank you.
That was Sahar Francis, Palestinian lawyer working with Palestinian prisoners' issues for 30 years, testifying about sexual assault and mass imprisonment at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey in October 2025. For more information about the Gaza Tribunal, visit www.gazatribunal.com. By the way, a new comprehensive United Nations Human Rights Report was released on January 7, 2026, titled Thematic Report, Israel's Discriminatory Administration of the Occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. I have a link to that report on our website, arabvoices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.